Welcome back to Current State. This is 90.5 WKAR, and that is music coming to you live today from Current State, courtesy of the Michigan Jazz Trail, a nonprofit based in Midland, dedicated to promoting Michigan's jazz scene. Today's players are all music professors at Central Michigan University. We welcome Three Chips, Bob Lindahl on trombone, John Nickel on tenor sax, and we just heard Jeff Kressler on keys. So we'll hear more from the CMU trio coming up this hour. Also later this hour, we update options for addressing Asian carp in the Great Lakes. Current State contributor Gary Wilson is all over that. And one other music-related segment today as well. Melissa Benmark previews the next Lansing Symphony Orchestra performance. We're glad you're along here today for Friday. A Cooley Law School professor will oversee an independent review of the embattled Lansing Board of Water and Light. Lansing Mayor Virge Bernero announced General Michael C.H. McDaniel's new role late Wednesday. Mr. McDaniel met the media yesterday. The retired military officer and former Homeland Security official will appoint members of a community review team that will conduct, in Mr. McDaniel's words, an objective, comprehensive, and transparent review of the utility's intensely criticized response to a December ice storm. The BWL says the storm resulted in power outages for up to at least 35,000 people, some for up to 11 days. And to learn more, we welcome General Michael McDaniel to Current State. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Things have moved pretty fast.
That's true.
Recently. Tell us how you ended up here. Did the mayor call you?
He did. He called me Tuesday morning about 10 a.m. I'd known the mayor for quite some time back when he was state senator and I was Homeland Security advisor. So he had called me and asked if I would do this. I needed a few hours, of course, to think it over, think about my term at Cooley Law School. I've got teaching responsibilities, which have to come first or come second after my family. And so I had to talk with the Cooley Dean and President Don LaDuke, and he graciously agreed that I could take this on.
How'd the mayor pitch this to you?
As I would expect that he would, he went directly to the idea that, you know, that I'm a public servant and the community needs me to do this. And I have been a public servant for 30 years, and so I agreed to do so.
And your Saturdays were getting a little dull around the house, not quite enough to do.
Well, yeah, I don't want to be missing any Spartan basketball games on Saturdays, Mark, but this will certainly fill in any spare time I might have.
Seriously, what in those hours that you took to evaluate this whole thing, what came to mind?
Well, that's a good question. I would say a couple things. First and foremost, I have always been a public servant, but it's usually been at the state or federal level. And this was an opportunity to give back to the community. And I was quite willing to do that after I thought about it for a while. Secondly, this is what I have done. I was in charge of Homeland Defense strategy and plans at the Pentagon for the Department of Defense, which included those which were comprehensive for all four branches of the military. Certainly had done this at the state level, had done this to some degree at the regional level as well, working with FEMA.
Done what exactly? I mean, involved with power and
no.
Utilities?
No, or? Indirectly, certainly. I do not claim to be a utility expert. I do not claim to be an expert on utility law. However, I have been intimately involved in critical infrastructure planning since the beginning of my time at Homeland Security. I was the critical infrastructure expert for the National Governors Association Homeland Security Council. I was the chair of the state, local, tribal council for the Department of Homeland Security, where all the state and local officials, and we had a group of like 20 that were in charge of doing critical infrastructure for the Department of Homeland Security. And at the Pentagon, I was in charge of the Defense Industrial Base, which meant I was very concerned with how power, almost all electrical power, goes into our military bases. It's like one long extension cord, say, from Fayetteville, North Carolina to Fort Benning. And so there's a lot of vulnerabilities reliant upon power. And we looked at ways to assure that the power source would be reliable and resilient. And, you know, that's sort of the motto of the Board of Water and Light. They say they are going to provide reliable, affordable power. And I guess I'm looking at that reliable piece, Mark.
Tell us about your review team then. How many will there be?
I don't have a fixed number. Let me first say that the review team will be appointed by me. I think it was very important that this team be independent from any of the communities, including the city of Lansing, and that it be independent from the Board of Water and Light. So I insisted that I had to be able to appoint all the members to the team. I'm expecting about 9 members. I expect it will be community-wide. It has to have representatives from East Lansing, Delta and Delhi Township, as well as the city of Lansing. And so I've also talked to the mayor of East Lansing yesterday afternoon, and I'll talk to the township supervisors for Delta and Delhi, and I'll be asking them for their recommendations as well. As that of the Lansing mayor. But again, those are going to be recommendations. I'm going to appoint the members. I'm going to assume around 9 members.
Do you have any lined up already?
No.
Okay. What will the process be then here for assembly? I know you're soliciting applications.
That's right. True? That's right. Absolutely. I put out an email address, lansingcrt@gmail.com. Anyone who is interested in the community, all they have to do is send me an email with the expression of interest and send me their resume. I am certainly looking for individuals who are community representatives, but I'd like it to be sort of a twofer, if you'll pardon the expression. You know, it's someone who has a background in technology-driven customer support or customer service, background in emergency management, of course, background in crisis communications, crisis planning, background in the utility industry would be good as well, information technology field, somebody who's got some skills that we can have, as well as being a community representative would be good. And as I said yesterday, I don't want any politicians or aspiring politicians. This is not going to be glamorous whatsoever. It's going to be looking at exactly what went wrong as well as what went right and what needs to be fixed.
Would anybody who's been outspoken against, been highly critical of the Board of Water and Light, be eliminated from consideration?
I wouldn't say eliminated, but I would certainly take that into consideration, Mark. I've said from the beginning that this has to be objective as well as independent. And so I need people that clearly have that objectivity. Let's not forget that this is a report that has to be not only accepted by the community, but it has to be accepted by the city of Lansing and the mayor of, and the city council and the Board of Water and Light. They have to know that my team's work was objective so that they are willing to accept what might be some pretty strong recommendations.
Have you begun looking into what you'll focus on?
I've certainly considered it. At this point, really, Mark, I'm more concerned or more focused on the process. And it seems to me the process is first I need to come up with those team members, appoint the team no later than next Wednesday so that I can announce the members of the CRT. At that point, I'm going to start taking community input. I'm going to ask the members of the community to use that same email address, lansingcrt@gmail.com, and send me their comments, send me their concerns. Again, what went right, what went wrong, their thoughts on what needs to be fixed or what should be done differently. And I want them to look at it broadly because my team's going to look at it broadly. Then I'll have a series of public meetings. Got to have at least 3, it seems to me, one in Delta Township, one in Lansing, one in East Lansing. At a minimum, I would note that Board of Water and Light is already saying that they're doing that next week. Mine will probably be the week after, so we don't have too much interference or confusion. I will certainly ask the Board of Water and Light to record, have a transcript or some sort of recording of their public hearing so that I can have full input on what was said at their public hearing. Again, in case there's any confusion between the two. I will also, of course, be taking an input, as I said, through the email, and then I'll have a series of 3 public meetings myself. I think the second phase of that, if I could just continue, would be
sure.
I need simultaneously I need to get all the documentation from the Board of Water and Light. Any plans that they have in place now, any plans that they had in place prior to December 21st, and I need to see the communication string. How was command and control affected within the Board of Water and Light? So not just looking at communications to their stakeholders and their customers, but how did they do that contingency decision-making?
Internally.
That's right.
Is that what you mean?
That's right.
No.
And let me just say that a good plan is not like, this person goes to this location. A good contingency plan is but a platform for contingency decision making. You take the the five most common natural disasters. I picked five out of the air. The number is irrelevant because it depends on where you are. California or Hawaii is going to have more than five potential natural disasters. But it seems to me here it's going to be ice storms, heat waves, tornadoes, earthquakes, and, of course, blizzards and flooding. So, you know, you've got the natural disasters, and you think about what are the man-made incidents could occur. And you think of all the potential contingencies there. And then those have to be captured within the plan, not specifics, but, okay, if this is what we think is going to happen, what are the potential consequences? What are the potential first and second effects as in order from that? And then you say, how do we do our decision-making from that? And it's that contingency decision-making, I think, that is the most problematic. Many times, I don't know in this case, but it's possible, given the delay of 10 or 11 days to response, that there was not a clear operating picture across the board. And that's one of the things that we'll know when we look at the plan. And then, of course, after I got that information, the second phase is to do interviews with Board of Water and Light employees and staff. The third phase would be to bring in subject matter experts.
Have you read enough about this episode that you're having to let go of any of the reporting that you've read about this that you might have that's already in your head with regard to the Board of Water and Light's response?
No, I sort of let it all go because I have to be objective and look at this clean when I see not what's reported, but when I see what information the Board of Water and Light actually either had or generated at the time. And let me emphasize here that to do this thoroughly, which I insisted with Mayor Bernero, it had to be thorough. It has to be not just the response. We have to look at planning and preparation on the front end. What happened prior to December 21st? The year or two before that? What plans did they have in place? How did they train their staff to those plans? Did they ever exercise those plans? Then you look at the response itself, and then we look at the long-term recovery as well.
To what extent do you think you'll have to rely on the board's version of events and data, et cetera? And does that concern you? For example, there seems to be some confusion as to exactly how many customers were affected and for how long. That's been fluid, shall we say. Do you expect to determine those numbers independently?
I don't know that the actual number is as important to me. That's a great question, by the way. But I don't know if the actual number is as important as it is. The importance is whether or not the Board of Water and Light knew exactly how many customers they had out. I mean, they have to have a clear operating picture as to what their response is going to be. You have to have some sense of how many customers are out on day one, day two, day three, day four, and how they're working through that. Now, who had that information? You know, did they have an emergency operations center where this information was clear? The purpose of an emergency operations center is so that all of the most important internal, as well as there'll be some external assistance, but that decision-making, that contingency decision-making, as I said before, so that they clearly understand exactly what they're dealing with. In any crisis, in any event that you're responding to, that is fluid and that information is going to change. So the fact that it may have been 25,000 on one day and 30,000 on another day is not as important as why was the number going up, and is it because they weren't aware of on day one how many outages they had and why? And is it unclear as to whether or not there was subsequent events, whether there was internal failings within the system itself that caused the number to go up? I don't know at this point.
But does it concern you that you may have to rely on their data and their version of events?
Oh, no, because there'll be ways to look at that objectively. This is going to be compared against, you know, industry standards and best practices. So if, in fact, you know, as I said, it's not necessarily the numbers they say, but when they knew those numbers and when they claim they knew those numbers, which will be more important to use that example.
Are you confident you'll get the cooperation from the Board of Water and Light that you will need to conduct this investigation?
Yes, I
Does
think so.
Does that concern you?
Well, I think only in the sense that it's on a long list of concerns. I mean, one of the things, as I said, part of phase two is I've got to get all the information from the Board of Water and Light. So it's a concern in that sense. Do I think they're going to withhold information? Of course not. I mean, the public opinion, the public focus on them is so great that I think that if I had to state publicly that that my report has been delayed because I haven't gotten information from the Board of Water and Light, that would be very telling to the community. So I don't think that's going to happen.
How big a part of your investigation will the general manager be, Peter Lark? Will you be relying on him specifically to significantly?
I don't think so. You know, there's always as I said before, command and control, the decision-making process is extremely important. So that will be looked at. Who makes decisions? Is it the general manager? Is there an emergency operations manager? Is the current day-to-day operations manager become the emergency operations manager? If so, what's the reporting mechanism from him to the general manager and from the general manager up to the board itself? I mean, that will be looked at closely in terms of how the command and control structure works and how it works differently as it should in the middle of a crisis or event like this.
At the media gathering yesterday, you described Peter Lark as a friend and went on to describe working with him at the state years ago. Do you anticipate any resistance because of that? Can you understand how some Lansing residents might be skeptical about objectivity and independence if you've established some kind of acquaintance with the top executive of the utility you're investigating?
Sure, and that's why I addressed it right from the very beginning, Mark. I mean, let's face it, Lansing is a small town. When I was hired 30 years ago with the Attorney General's office, you know, Frank Kelly said Michigan is nothing but a big, small town, and everybody will know what you're doing. And I think that's true in this case, as it should be. But, you know, I haven't worked with Peter Lark in over 12 years. The last time I could possibly have worked with him is 2002, when I left the Attorney General's office, when Attorney General Granholm became Governor Granholm and appointed me Homeland Security Advisor. And I haven't worked with Peter since. So it should not be a problem. And I emphasize that only because I wasn't hired or appointed. I shouldn't say hired. This is obviously without compensation whatsoever. I wasn't appointed to do this because I was at the Attorney General's office some time ago, and so was Peter Lark. I was appointed to do this because of my expertise in Homeland Security planning.
How long do you expect the review will take, and will a final report be issued?
90 days. I sort of set that, but Mayor Bernero certainly agreed. There's no reason to drag this out. Again, I mean, that's taken up the entire school term. And that's the most time I really feel that we can spend on doing this. There will, of course, be a written report. That report has to be public. Again, as I said before, not only does this have to be independent and objective, it has to be transparent.
And recommendations will be a part of it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I expect there'll be a series of recommendations. Recommendations on the areas the key areas that I mentioned, planning and preparation, the response and the recovery.
Remind us again of the timeline here in terms of lining up the people that will be part of the team.
Yeah, thank you. I'd like to have the team in place by next Wednesday.
Okay.
And again, any members of the public who have some interest, this is a community review team, so I need your support, lansingcrt@gmail.com.
Well, it's been an enlightening segment here. We appreciate it a lot. General Mike McDaniel's new role is as the head of the community review team looking into the Board of Water and Light response to the recent ice storm. We'll stay in touch. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Music coming to you live from Current State here on Friday. Bob Lindahl on trombone, John Nickel on tenor sax, and Jeff Kressler at the keyboards. All are music professors at Central Michigan University, and we'll hear from them again before the hour is out. It's Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Earlier this week, the Army Corps of Engineers released the results of its 18-month study designed to deal with Asian carp in the Chicago waterways system. The study was mandated by Congress as the threat of the invasive species to the Great Lakes ecosystem continues to increase. Now, eight options were presented, with the most comprehensive one physically separating the Great Lakes from the Mississippi River. But it comes at a price, as you would imagine, $18 billion, and it would take 25 years, the Corps study says. The study comes on the heels of another recent report that Asian carp DNA may have been found in Lake Michigan near Green Bay, Wisconsin. Current State's regular Great Lakes contributor Gary Wilson joins us from Chicago to tell us about the study and the reactions it is generating. Welcome back, Gary.
Hey, Mark. Good to be with you, and welcome back from Pasadena.
Thank you. I appreciate it. The tan has faded.
Okay. And you come back to Lansing with minus zero or less or colder and no electricity.
It was quite a readjustment. We'll just put it that way. Put this in context for us, Gary. There's a lot of studies coming out of the on the Great Lakes, a lot of discussion about invasive species. But this was a pretty big study, as I understand, and it's attracted a lot more attention. Why is that?
Well, it's a landmark study, Mark. The invasive species issue, especially Asian carp, everybody knows Asian carp because they're big and they jump out of the water and land in your boat and have a chance of decimating the Great Lakes fishery. So everybody focuses on Asian carp. But this study, which is really driven by Asian carp approaching Chicago and with a chance to get into Lake Michigan, is a landmark. Everybody has been waiting for this. Congress mandated that the Corps, as you mentioned, the Corps do this study. Everything has kind of been on hold, and it affects the region. So everybody has been waiting for the Corps to present this 18-month work, and they did this week. And I happened to be at the hearing, the first hearing that they're conducting, public comment period, last night in Chicago, and there was a tremendous level of interest. So there's an opportunity here for the Great Lakes region to do something about invasive species and Asian carp. Now we have to see what happens. It's a big deal.
Has there been much reaction so far?
There's a ton of reaction. It's really puzzling, Mark. I've scanned the politicians' websites. I've looked at the editorial boards from around the region. And everybody is just a little bit puzzled. But this report is very comprehensive. You know, the $18 billion price tag for physical separation of the Great Lakes from the Mississippi, boy, that it just has everybody's attention. You know, we're in a time of budget cutting, and there's hardly a day that you don't go by, and, you know, in the national media that you don't see people sparring over how much money the country is spending. So now the fix for Asian carp to protect the Great Lakes, the best fix, is $18 billion. And as I mingled last night talking with people, they're just trying to figure out what to do with the report. It's over 200 pages, has a ton of appendices and analysis. And people right now, politicians, environmental groups, business groups, they're all in the role of trying to digest this thing.
$18 billion is a whopping figure, but by the same token, a lot of people would stand to be impacted by this. I mean, the entire Great Lakes region, how insurmountable does that seem to you?
The $18 billion figure is, I believe, going to be very insurmountable. You know, advocates would say, okay, $18 billion, yes, it's a big number, and the final number could be less than that, and even the Army Corps admits that this is a conceptual number. But when you look at what's at risk, you know, the number associated with the Great Lakes fishery is $7 billion, so if that was wiped out, you know, the $18 billion doesn't look like such a big number. But there's an undercurrent here about the $18 billion that's grabbing all the headlines. You know, the worst-kept secret in all of this is the Army Corps didn't really want to do this report.
Why not?
They just don't believe in the project, I don't believe. Mark, 2 years ago I sat in federal court and listened to Major General Peabody from the Army Corps, who was the head of the Chicago District at the time, testify in Michigan's CARP case that, he just didn't believe in the physical infrastructure separation project, the timeline and the cost. But he's a good soldier, and he said if Congress authorized it and the president signed it, of course he would do it, and he would do his best job. The Corps was forced into this project and analysis, and they've done exactly what General Peabody said they would do. They did what they perceived to be their best work, and now they're handing it off. But they don't have ownership. They're not going to take ownership of the next steps. That's going to be up to other people in the region.
These eight options range from doing nothing to replumbing Chicago, and that is quite a spread. Tell us about some of the other options that jumped out at you, Gary.
Well, there is an interim. The big one is the $18 billion one, and that's replumbing Chicago, physically separating the Great Lakes from the Mississippi. And while Chicago gets all the attention, it's also Northwest Indiana. And Northwest Indiana folks in general, including Governor Spence, are very skeptical about any Army Corps project. They haven't necessarily had good experiences. But there was an interim step, one of the interim options, that would cost less, and that involves building a lock, plural locks, where ships and barges passing through the Chicago waterway system would go into a lock and be sanitized against invasive species, for lack of a better term. And then, they would be allowed to exit the lock. So the assumption is that no water transfers, and any invasives that could be attached to the boat or in that lock water would be killed, theory being that the boat would be safe to transfer and invasive species would be kept at bay. That's sort of the middle ground. Environmental groups aren't happy with it. They want physical separation, and that's all they want.
They pretty much galvanized around that idea, correct?
They are. They're very galvanized, and they feel like they can take no other position. The one word that kept popping up last night at the public comment period, Mark, was opportunity. This region has an opportunity right now to do something about invasive species. The Corps report can be the catalyst for it, but that opportunity is not going to be here forever, and the clock is ticking as the carp are swimming. So if this thing languishes, that opportunity could be lost.
Are you still in a position, Gary, then, where you're waiting for government officials to respond to the report then?
They've responded, but the responses have been kind of quizzical. And, I was talking with John Allen a couple of days ago from Michigan's Office of the Great Lakes, and his response was fairly typical from what you see around the region at various levels. And it's kind of like, okay, we've got the report. We know what the scenarios are. And he kind of left it at that. The unanswered question is, what's the next step and who's going to take it? There was a lot of talk about consensus building to get this thing rolling, but very little talk about who's going to step up and lead and build that consensus. I think that's what the politicians, environmental groups, are trying to figure out right now. It's not going to be easy.
Well, the Great Lakes governors met on this last spring at Mackinac Island, and at that gathering, the governor of Illinois, Pat Quinn, signaled that he was open to the idea of a permanent barrier. The governor of Indiana, Mike Pence, had opposite sentiment, saying that the idea was basically a non-starter. We're just basically in a situation, in a pattern right now, though, where we're waiting for these key people to weigh in and waiting for somebody to step up?
That's absolutely correct, Mark. And one of those key people could have been Senator Durbin from Illinois. He's been, softly supportive of environmental groups He's been pressuring the Corps to produce this study. But his statement after the Corps released its report was pretty telling. And it's brief. I'll read it here. He says, I'm talking about physical separation, though popular with some, complete separation of the Mississippi and Lake Michigan would be one of the most costly water projects in the nation. I've seen too many of these long-term core projects languish for years and fall victim to congressional inaction. We can't gamble with the threat of Asian carp invading the Great Lakes or severe flooding in Chicago by pursuing a risky project like this at the expense of our current efforts. That's fairly telling. He could have been a champion for this, and it sounds like now he's pulling back. So we'll have to see.
As a guy who covers this story continually, what's next on your radar? What are you waiting to have happen?
Well, there's an event in Washington, D.C. in late February or early March. It's called Great Lakes Days, and the most of the Great Lakes community goes to Washington. It's led by the Great Lakes Commission in Ann Arbor. They go to Washington, and they meet, and they lobby for various projects, not just the Asian carp issue, but for funding and a whole range of things. That's seen as the opportunity because you're in Washington, D.C. You'll have access to congressional leaders to really make a case and lobby for somebody to take hold of this. Between now and then, I think everybody's going to be doing their diligence and trying to get their ducks in order and develop a plan. But they've got to find somebody or some multiples of people to step up and take ownership of this and move it along.
We will remind our listeners that there are two public comment sessions scheduled to respond to the Army Corps study, one of them in Ann Arbor, Tuesday the 21st, 4 to 7 p.m. at the University of Michigan League on North University. Also, 2 days later in Traverse City, 4 to 7 p.m. at the Hagerty Conference Center, Northwest Michigan College. Gary Wilson's an independent journalist based in Chicago. You can catch his review of the top stories out of the Great Lakes on the last Tuesday of every month here on Current State. Gary, thanks as always. Have a great weekend.
Good to be with you, Mark. Thank you.
We're going to let these guys stretch their legs, for sure. Bob Lindahl on trombone, John Nickel on tenor sax, and Jeff Kressler on keyboards. All three are music professors at Central Michigan University, and our music coming to you today, courtesy of the Michigan Jazz Trail, a nonprofit based in Midland, dedicated to promoting Michigan's jazz scene. More from the CMU. Can we call them the professors of jazz? I think that's certainly appropriate, although I feel like folks at MSU may have staked that name out already. But we'll get back to the players here in just a few minutes. Speaking of music, the Lansing Symphony Orchestra's next concert is tomorrow night at Wharton Center. The program will be mostly Russian ballet music from several eras. In Current State's Melissa Benmark spoke with conductor Timothy Muffet about the music being featured. Melissa joins us. Welcome back to Current State.
Hi there. Thanks for having me. Really enjoyed, as always, talking to Timothy Muffet. He is such an interesting guy. And this particular interview was fun for me because it brought back all kinds of memories of being a ballet crazy kid.
Oh.
You know, with the Tchaikovsky ballets being featured or some of the ballet music being featured in this concert. And one really cool thing about this concert that Timothy Muffet has constructed it in kind of a bookend way.
This is definitely a program about Tchaikovsky and his influence. I don't think it's hyperbole to say that Tchaikovsky was the greatest Russian composer to have lived, or certainly among the most important, given his influence. So, you know, we look at the other great Russian composers, Prokofiev, Shostakovich, Stravinsky. Their style was so much informed by Tchaikovsky. Tchaikovsky really came along and changed the face of music in many ways. And we don't really think of him as an innovator because he was the flowering of Romanticism and he was the typical tortured soul romantic artist. That we often don't think of him as an innovator, but he very much was an innovator, and a lot of that innovation happened in the ballets, his three big ballets, Nutcracker, Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty. So much so, you know, the first time a celesta was ever used was in the Nutcracker. It was a musical secret weapon that was, and he treated it that way. It was like the unfolding of this remarkable new instrument.
So the audience is going, what is this?
What is that? Right. And so I think that Tchaikovsky as an innovator is kind of underappreciated. But certainly two people who appreciated him greatly were Stravinsky and Shostakovich, the other two composers that are on this concert. Stravinsky would say that Tchaikovsky and Mozart were his two favorite composers. And the great urban legend says that when Stravinsky was asked, of all the pieces that you didn't write, what do you wish you had written? And his answer to that is the waltz from Swan Lake.
Because it's hard to imagine that connection,
it's
though.
It's hard to
imagine
it. Right. To Stravinsky as this, you know, the avant-garde and the really changing the face of music, was his roots were in Tchaikovsky. Look at how many ballets he wrote. And so the tradition of the Russian ballet composer comes right out of Tchaikovsky. And so it's no surprise that Stravinsky penned one of the works on this program, the Divertimento from Fairy's Kiss, which is an homage to Tchaikovsky. To the point where he uses bits and pieces of Tchaikovsky's music, wraps them in a Stravinskian package. However, there are many passages in this music that will sound just as though Tchaikovsky wrote them. And it's a remarkably beautiful score and a very fresh voice from Stravinsky. It's a really great, great piece of music. So, as you pointed out, we open with Tchaikovsky, we close with Tchaikovsky, and then we have a Stravinsky homage to Tchaikovsky kind of in the middle. And all of this while everyone's ears are still fresh from hearing Nutcracker for the last 6 weeks in one form or another. So hopefully that helps people make the connection when they hear this. And then the other work on the program is we have the Shostakovich Cello Concerto. Shostakovich, also a composer greatly influenced by Tchaikovsky.
Talk a little bit about your soloist in that.
Oh, David Ricciero is definitely a rising star on the cello scene. In fact, just this morning there was a review in the New York Times praising his playing. So that was nice to see and timely. He's just an emerging talent. He was a winner of the Nomberg Prize recently, and which is one of the big awards in our field. And we're excited to share him with this audience.
I was reading a little bit that Tchaikovsky, when writing Sleeping Beauty and Swan Lake was first, and it wasn't terribly well received, that he had to kind of get someone to explain the technical stuff to him about how you write for dancers.
Right.
And yet and Swan Lake was criticized for being too complicated and not really holding up as a ballet. And it's interesting to me that probably more often than not, when you hear this music now, it is still in the concert hall and not necessarily in ballet form.
Yes, it's of course hugely expensive to mount a ballet, and there's something about the story ballets are falling by the wayside a little bit. You know, I think the ballet world is moving towards kind of a different format. I don't think that these will ever fall out of the repertoire, the big three Tchaikovsky story ballets, and I'm not surprised to hear that. That remark about him having to learn about the dance, because what I do notice in his music is that there is. It's very dance specific. There are certain tempi and musical character moments that are so obviously connected to movement. And a certain expansiveness to the music and just a remarkable broad pace that you can just tell there's movement on stage that's going along with this. Things that he doesn't do in his symphonies, for example. Musical paragraphs that we wouldn't find in a symphony that we do find in the ballet music. But I think they work beautifully in the concert hall because it's just extraordinary music.
It does have a natural danceability about it. I think when I was, you know, teeny and wanted to be a ballerina when I grew up, this is the first stuff I would dance to in the living room.
You bet.
And it just feels like it wants that, but it doesn't lose anything by just being heard either.
I agree. One of the things that Tchaikovsky did that made him kind of a revolutionary ballet composer was the way he wrote characterization into his music. So that no longer was ballet music just something that had a good beat and you could dance to it, but all of a sudden the music was reflecting the character of the moment, reflecting the character of the character. The great example that I think of is Drosselmeyer's entrance in Nutcracker, where that music is just exactly who that character is. And I think that's what really changed the face of music for ballet, and one of the important contributions Tchaikovsky made that those that followed him really latched onto.
Timothy Muffet, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Earlier this hour, we enjoyed music from CMU music professors Bob Lindahl, John Nickel, and Jeff Kressler. They are here at Current State as part of our partnership with the Michigan Jazz Trail, which is sending us fabulous Michigan-based jazz musicians to play live for us on the second Friday of each month. Again, all our music professors at CMU, we want to welcome Bob Lindahl, John Nickel, and Jeff Kressler to Current State. Thanks for coming in this morning.
Yeah, great to be
here.
Thanks
for having us.
Is it hard to generate some heat with music at this hour?
Not with these gentlemen.
Okay.
It's fun.
It depends on who you're playing with. Yeah. Is that it?
That's right.
Tell us a little bit about yourself, John.
Saxophone professor at Central Michigan University. I've been there for 33 years and enjoy playing in the CMU faculty jazz ensemble with these gentlemen.
A lot of people around Lansing know Jeff Kressler. Jeff, remind our listeners.
Well, I'm a retired band director from DeWitt High School, and I teach part-time at CMU the jazz piano.
Okay. And Bob, our trombone player.
I'm the trombone professor at CMU, and I enjoy getting out and playing with groups like the Michigan Jazz Trail and the River Raisin Ragtime Review Band and the CMU Jazz Faculty, and Michigan's a great place to be playing.
Well, remind our listeners what the Jazz Trail is all about.
Jazz Trail Orchestra started 5 years ago, and it was the brainchild of Molly McFadden, and she's a very dynamic person and believed in this as something that should happen and could be a benefit to the state of Michigan. So Molly started the idea and worked with Jeff Hall at Saginaw Valley State University, and then Jeff organizes the band, picks the charts for us, and between the two of them, we have gigs, and there's a board of directors also that works very hard to promote the band.
What's the jazz scene like in Michigan right now, Jeff?
Well, I think it's pretty good, particularly in mid-Michigan. I mean, we've got a really fine jazz department of the College of Music here at MSU. We have JAM, which is it's a local organization called Jazz Alliance of Mid-Michigan. And they're very active, and they support jazz and send out newsletters and information about performers and where they're playing in the area. So there's a lot of interest here.
What's the website again?
For
Please.
JAM, I think it's just...
No, I meant the Jazz Trail, actually.
Oh, I don't know what...
Google. We can Google.
Probably just Google Jazz Michigan Trail. Jazz Trail.
There we go. Mm-hmm. Okay. When in doubt, go to Google. You're all CMU music professors. Bob, what do you enjoy about teaching music at the college level?
I enjoy the students. My favorite thing is I'm a teacher first before anything else, and I love working with college-age students and watching them develop. It's amazing how far they go in 4 or 5 years, and you just push them along and make them work hard and get enjoyable results.
Do their interests tend to become more oriented toward jazz during their college years, or do you get a lot of students who walk in the door the first time they meet you and they're nuts about jazz?
I think most of them walk in the door. If they have a background with their high school jazz programs, they walk in the door with that interest. There are some that didn't have that background in high school that get turned on when they're in college.
Tell us about, you've got a couple of CDs as well.
Yes, we produced two CDs. A Conspiracy Theory is one of them. Actually, the first one was Caught in the Act. So we've got two groups featuring the music of our director of jazz studies, Robbie Smith. And, yeah, and we've enjoyed producing those CDs, creating them. It's been a lot of fun. So hope, you know, others.
Yeah, Robbie also plays in the Michigan Jazz Trails big band. That's a great thing about Michigan Jazz Trails is it incorporates musicians from throughout mid-Michigan and Detroit area.
Well, around the state, right, really. I mean, right. The whole idea is to kind of replicate this idea of a trail all around the state of Michigan, yeah, where there's jazz at all these various destinations. Molly was a guest on the show last month.
Oh, was she? So, yeah. All right. And we just wanted to put in a little bit of a plug for a gig we have coming up, Mark. It's on February 14th in Bay City at the State Theater, and it has a theme. It's an evening of memorable, magical, romantic moments from the movies.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so that should be fun.
That's a lot of M's.
That's a lot of M's.
We're going to let Bob, Jeff, and John make their way back to their instruments. Bob's already got his trombone in hand, but Jeff and John are going to make their way over, and they're going to serenade us out of the program. A reminder that tomorrow on Current State Weekend, Emmanuel Berry features live music from Lansing artist Jen Sidgett. Learn more about Jen's latest project with her group Stella and why open mic nights matter. That and more arts and culture coverage tomorrow on Current State Weekend. What are you gonna take us out on here, guys?
All of Me.
A standard. We love it. It's the CMU Professors of Jazz with All of Me on Current State. Thank you. That's our program for today. We're glad you could join us. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening to Current State on WKAR.